Support for the following program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional funding comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Southern Voices, this week on Soundings. Join me now for conversations with writers Larry Brown and Elizabeth Spencer. I'll talk first with Larry Brown about his latest book, a novel entitled Joe. Later on the program, Elizabeth Spencer talks about her latest novel, a book entitled The Night Travelers. Place, family, and history are central to the work of most Southern writers. That's certainly the case with Larry Brown's latest novel, entitled Joe, and published by Algonquin Books. Set in contemporary Mississippi, Joe is a tale of families, loyalties, and betrayals. Among the characters in the novel are two men and a youngster, Joe Ransom, Wade Jones, and Wade's son Gary, whom Joe Ransom befriends. Both Joe and Wade are fixed in their ways and uncompromising, traits that lead them to sorrow and violence, but also, in Joe's case, to moments of unexpected tenderness and compassion. Reading from his new novel, here's Larry Brown.
He stepped into the hall and opened the door on the right. The room was dark and unoccupied. The door on the left was closed, and he knocked gently before he opened it. A wan blue light from a silent television screen filled with snow cast the room in a shadowy glow. A vague, inconsistent light where sleeping figures sprawled. There was an old army cot against one wall, and Henry was piled up in it, naked but for his underwear, his arm over his face. Stacy was in a battered recliner with a quilt thrown over him, his head back, eyes closed, mouth wide open. And George, the blind brother, sat in a straight-backed wooden chair with a 9mm in his hand, and a dead woman at his feet, whose blood had come out of her body and made a dark rug on the floor around her. He held the pistol in one hand and a glass of something in the other. His hair was white, shaggy, disordered. The radio played country tunes softly. He said one word, Joe. But his visitor had no wish to be verified, and he did not answer. He let himself out as quietly as he had let himself in, and got back in his truck and drove home through the black night, into Oak Hollows, past standing deer with eyes like bright green jewels, who raised their ears and stared as he passed by them and beyond.
Now, Larry Brown, if I wanted to accuse you of philosophizing, I could say, man, what you have just read to me here is some sort of Southern existentialist night of hell. What about that? What were you doing in this grim passage?
Well, he had been over here. He had been over to this house before, had actually been shot himself there. And
it's a gambling house.
The gambling house, and A lot of rough people hung out there, and a lot of rough things went on, and he just happened to come by at the wrong time, and he saw very quickly that he did not want his presence known there, so he wouldn't be implicated in any way.
Well, let's get the obvious question out of the way. Are you Joe Ransom?
Oh, no, no.
Where did he come from?
Well, he's just a combination of people I've known, worked around all my adult life there in Mississippi, in the rural area that I grew up in.
He is an alcoholic. He has a lot of violence in him, has trouble with his family. I guess the 50-cent word here would be dysfunctional. Why is it that you would put somebody as distasteful, as unpleasant as this before the public and present him as somebody that you want them to know, I guess, huh?
Yeah, well, I think we all probably have, you know, good points and bad points about us. He does have a lot of bad things about him, but in the ways he tries to help Gary, you know, he shows a good side too, that he's human.
Do you know Gary? Where did he come from?
Well, those people are actually kind of modeled after some people that I once knew who were not in as bad a shape as the people in my novel, but they they were kind of, you know, just rootless, just moved around, working where they could, picking produce here and there in whatever was in season in whatever state.
I thought, for example, about the Jode family in the Grapes of Wrath. Do you get a lot of literary models thrown at you? Is that who you are imitating, that sort of stuff? What about that?
Yeah, I've seen several reviews that that compared it to the Jodes, and also to Flimp's, comparing Wade especially to Flimp's Notes.
He really is one of the most nasty, evil characters I've come across in a long time. Mm-hmm. Did you have a word like evil in your mind hovering there in front of the paper or the word processor when you created Wade Jones?
Yeah, I wanted him to be as despicable as I could make him. You know, I wanted the reader to hate him. Yeah, I wanted to show that boy had this terrible home life and how destitute he was and how badly he needed a job and needed to make some money just to help feed his family.
What about a word like love? It doesn't appear often in this book as a word or as a theme, and yet it has a powerful kind of force in the relationship. I guess it's mainly unspoken between Joe and this youngster that he befriends. How about that?
Yeah, it's there. It's not, you know, he doesn't bring it out and just say it, but it's there. He cares about the kid, and he feels sorry for him. He knows what his life is like, and if he can, he would like to help it be a little better, a little easier if he could give the kid a few chances that he's never had.
All right. Well, now one of your reviewers has suggested that in the name Ransom, you have you've put on the table right there the function that this main character serves. Is that what was in your mind when you began the book? In other words, do you know how it's going to end when you sit down and start to create these people?
No, I didn't. I didn't in this case. I've been working on this novel for over 6 years. I really can't remember, around 84, 85. It was the sixth novel I had started. The other five had gone unpublished. But as far as his name, no, I didn't really mean for that to have any significance. That's a name I had heard before in Mississippi, and I just simply used it.
Uh-huh. Now, here you've just used the word Mississippi, Larry Brown. Another question that's important and obvious, I got to put to you. What does it mean to be a Southern writer? What about coming out of the Southern tradition? Do you get tired of that sort of thing, or...?
No, I don't get tired of it at all. I'm glad to be a Southern writer, and I don't have any problem being identified as that. But I really don't think that my work is just bound to one region, because I get too many letters from people in California and New York City telling me how much they like it.
Uh-huh. What about the immense burden of having been compared by no less than Cleanth Brooks to William Faulkner? How about that?
Yeah, that was real nice. That was a real nice essay Mr. Brooks wrote. I appreciated that a lot. But I don't really feel that I have that much in common with Faulkner, except that we're both writing about the same kind of people in the same part of the country, although, I mean, they're in very different eras.
Uh-huh. Are you conscious, Larry Brown, of what the academics call a Southern tradition in literature? I mean, do you make it a point to go back and read people like... Faulkner or Tate, John Crow Ransom, goodness, I mean, there are just dozens of writers in the South, and model yourself on one or more of them?
Not really, not now. At one time, there was a point where I thought I wanted to try to write like Faulkner, but eventually I discovered that the whole thing about becoming a writer is finding your own voice and not imitating anybody and trying to be completely original.
What does it mean? What does it mean to you to have found your voice? Have you found it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I use different points of view telling things. You know, a lot of my stuff has been written in the first person, a good bit of it. But from the start, I had the idea to write this novel in a completely different narrative drive from what I had done before.
How does your imagination work? I mean, do you sit and make notes to yourself? You say you carry things around in your head. What does that mean?
Well, once in a while, I'll get an idea, but the idea won't be fully developed. But it'll be so urgent that it won't get out of my head, and I'll know then when that happens that I have a story to write. And then I, like I say, I just carry it around in my head and think about it for a while and try to figure it out. And then hopefully, by the time I sit down at the typewriter, I kind of know where it's going.
You worked at the fire department. You were a captain in the Oxford, Mississippi fire department. Did these guys that you work with, did they say, what is this wussy thing you're doing here, becoming a writer? What about that?
Well, I was of the opinion, you know, I never did go and blow it around much that I was a writer, because if you haven't published anything, you tell somebody a writer, the first thing they're going to ask you is, what have you published? You know? So I never did tell it too much. And then I published my first story in 1982 in Easy Riders, and that created something of a stir, but it was nearly 2 more years before I published another story, and it was in a literary magazine, wasn't seen generally, you know. So I think maybe sometimes they might have thought I was just a little bit strange, you know, instead of playing poker or watching a movie, I would usually keep my nose stuck in a book. They probably thought I was unsociable part of the time.
Larry Brown, read me another passage from your novel, Joe.
Okay, I'll read the epilogue on the last page here. That winter, the trees stood nearly barren of their leaves, and the cold seemed to settle into the old log house deep in the woods. The old woman felt it seep into her bones. Each morning, the floor seemed colder. Each day, it was harder to crank the truck. The boy piled wood for colder days to come. At odd times of the day, they'd hear the faint honking, and they'd hurry out into the yard to see overhead, and far beyond the range of men's guns, the geese spread out over the sky in a distant brotherhood, the birds screaming to each other in happy voices for the bad weather they were leaving behind, the southlands always ahead of their wings, warm marshes and green plants beckoning them to their ancient primeval nesting lands. They'd stand looking up until the geese diminished and fled crying out over the heavens and away into the smoking clouds, their voices dying slowly. One last note, the only sound and proof of their passing. That and the final wink of motion that swallowed them up into the sky and the earth that met it, and the pine trees always green and constant against the great blue wildness that lay forever beyond.
Now, Larry, I'll tell you, that isn't exactly a happy passage, but it's one of the few in this novel, Joe, where there is anything even approaching happiness. Do you? Mm-hmm. Is that a word in your vocabulary as you write these books?
Yeah, I'm a pretty happy guy.
Yeah, you seem so, you know, sort of self-possessed and calm and serene in these violent characters and situations that you create.
Mm-hmm, yeah, I don't know where it comes from, you know. I never have been able to explain it. People, I've been asked about it plenty of times, and I just say, well, you know, it may be brutal, but I also believe that it's honest.
Well, Larry Brown, I appreciate your coming by the National Humanities Center. A couple of your titles here, Facing the Music, wonderful collection of stories. Joe is the new novel, Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. I appreciate your time here at the center, and I wish you well in your work.
Well, thanks a lot, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Southern Voices, this week on Soundings. Join me now for a conversation with writer Elizabeth Spencer. We'll talk about her new book entitled The Night Travelers, published by Viking. Set at the time of the Vietnam War and focused on the interplay of political morality, social activism, and private lives, The Night Travelers moves between the American South of the 1960s and Canada, a place of refuge for many who protested America's involvement in the war in Vietnam. The novel tells the story of Jefferson Blaze, Mary Carr Harbison, their families, and friends. One critic notes that The Night Travelers explores the fate of idealism in a world riven by war and ideological hatreds, but does so without succumbing to counterculture parody. Reading from her new novel, here's Elizabeth Spencer.
The night we first came across the border, it was raining, and in the slant of wind, the rain kept slanting into the headlights, materializing white and steady, never stopping. So I asked if it could be snowing. It was only July. They laughed, the people driving us. No, it stopped sometime, maybe for 2 months. It was only rain, coming white at night on people traveling at night into a land not their own. This takes us back to the time of the Vietnam War, and the divisions in our society were so great at that time that just a little step beyond the division of opinion lay the world of violence of one citizen against another, or families divided against themselves.
You said, for example, that when Jefferson Blaze and Mary Carr, the two central leading characters in this novel, when they leave North Carolina, their lives become fragmented. They spin away from the center. Tell me about that.
Oh, well, yes. They live then not only traveling by night because of Jefferson Blaze's conviction put him at odds with the society that he's supposed to be a part of, makes him a divisive and person, and then they get separated and they have to pick up fragments of news about each other through letters that have to travel to them also by night or underground through from hand to hand.
Mm-hmm.
The letters get lost sometime, and the fragmented knowledge they have about one another, these two young people who are in love, who are married, who have a child, makes the whole relationship come at the reader in sort of like things picked up by chance.
Let's talk for a moment, Elizabeth Spencer, about some of the social threads that you tease out in The Night Travelers. You talk about war, you talk about Vietnam. Are you replaying the history of the Civil War? Is that an echo in Vietnam of what happened roughly 100 years before? I'm also tempted to ask you about what you're doing as a Southern novelist. You people are famous for your historical awareness. What about that?
I don't think the only comparison I can think of to the Civil War that I would make deliberately, and I don't think it's made in the book, except maybe Jefferson says once that this is a time of separation. I think he compares it in one of his philosophical musings to her. He compares it to the time of the Civil War. But it seemed to me, in reading as much as I did, and in talking to people as much as I did, and in thinking about it as much as I did, that this was probably the most divisive time in our history since the Civil War. I said that somewhere, but I don't know if it's in the book.
Do we get over these things, Elizabeth Spencer? Do we ever come to terms with our wars, our personal and our social wars?
I don't know. I hope that nothing else ever occurs that will draw us this far apart from one another. But I suppose a moral political issue is hard to escape. Some people are going to passionately take a side against the mainstream.
Where do you come down on this, Elizabeth? I want to read the writer behind the words, the author standing beside or beyond the pages. You have lived in both the South, the Deep South, now in North Carolina. You have lived in Montreal, the provincial, the international. When you looked at Vietnam and what happened in this country and created these characters, were you, in effect, passing judgment here, or are you sympathizing and agonizing with them?
I think I was more agonizing with them than not. The years that I'm from the deeper South than you imagine. I'm from Mississippi.
Carrollton, Mississippi.
Carrollton, Mississippi. But the whole experience of living in Montreal had nothing for, as I did for many years, in Canada. And the border they're crossing in that passage I read is, of course, the northern border into Canada. The viewpoint I had on the Vietnam War, my living in Canada, had nothing to do with that. It simply occurred as a crisis in the United States while I was living in Canada. Being American, I was, of course, naturally involved in the sense that I felt my country was making a vast mistake, but I had personally no way of expressing that at the time, and I'm not much of a macho or placard carrier.
Uh-huh.
I guess I wouldn't demonstrate really for anything except to give moral support where I could. But on the other hand, I did meet people. I did talk to people who were so involved that they, younger than I, it's true, came up there. And many of them I know still who found places in Canadian society and became Canadian.
Elizabeth, what does all this suffering produce? I mean, what good does it do these characters to suffer as deeply as they do?
they finally find their own relationship. I think by the end of the book that Jeff and Mary and Kathy are one unit as a family, no matter what happens in future.
Has he surrendered himself? Has he sold out, as it were, by signing up to go to Vietnam at the end of this book?
Well, I hate to tell the end before the... I don't think so. I think what happened there was, maybe it isn't brought out strongly enough in the text, that the rediscovery of his own father as part of a society and someone he could depend on made him more willing to make that compromise. But really, was it a compromise? He's a father now, definitely and permanently, and a husband.
And he feels that he has made his point, hasn't he?
He's made his point, and as Ethan Marbell before dying, or they decide together, we did make a difference.
Yeah, they said maybe we made the difference in as much as there were no nuclear weapons in Vietnam.
No nuclear weapons, and the war is winding down, remember, when Jeff has to go there. And so, I don't know, maybe he comes back. I wouldn't put the stamp of finishing anything. I don't think a novel is a finishing off of things.
Yeah, well, this almost sounds like a happy ending.
Well, you could read it that way. I think a novel is bringing people to a certain point. Huh. You asked me whose side I was on. I can see a whole lot of faults on both sides. And at one time I read so much and thought so much and talked to so many people about this period, and it seemed so extravagant in its different expressions of conviction, passionately held, it's true, but extravagant results, that I began to think a plague on both your houses. I want nothing to do with it. I'm glad I didn't have to make choices. But when you do make a choice, then there are going to be faults that come along with that. Nobody is pure 100% right.
Elizabeth, are you a pronouncer about public policy? Are you a deliverer of messages here about our national policy with respect to war? Here you're writing about Vietnam.
No, none of this book is laid in Vietnam, but two brief scenes at the end. I was trying to do what separates people, what tears people apart. In my sense of view of things, I see things through character. I'm a fiction writer.
Is this a political fable, or is it a love story?
It's more of a love story than it is a political fable, but it'd be hard to view this book without viewing it as a political novel. But I don't believe in treatises in fiction at all, because people are living through their histories in fiction just as they are in life, and we can't view life as trying to teach us something about politics. That would be impossible.
Why is it that it took from, what, the 70s through the 90s for you to write this book, Elizabeth? I mean, were we having a lot of incubation going on there?
I think so. I didn't ever occur to me to write a novel that was laid in the Vietnam period. I stumbled on this as the idea of a short story. Think of a person whose husband or lover or closest person in their lives is involved only through that person, has no political leaning whatsoever, but still is drawn into Canada. I thought it was a way to get at my own Canadian experience and the Canadian landscape and Canadian society by putting an American there, it would have to be an American from the South, in some kind of traumatic situation like this. What does she do? What does she think? How does she feel? And what happens?
What about the focal point on the relationship between Mary Carr and her mother rather than Jeff and his father? You begin, I don't want to say that you leave that relationship untested or undeveloped, but that is not as fully realized in this book as the relationship between the mother and the daughter. Do you do that because you were a woman and you were writing about what women know rather than what men know?
Well, I had to decide. It could easily have been, as someone said, the mother's story. It could easily have been Jeff's story. But it's easier for me as a woman, of course, to write about a woman. That's one thing. The other thing is, if I had come on too heavy with an emphasis on the story of Jeff and his father, that would have taken central place. But I wanted that as a shadow, a sort of watermark relationship under the text of Mary Carr's relationship to her mother, and that's terribly important, Jeff's relationship to his father, how it failed, and then finally he found a surrogate father in this politically minded professor.
Ethan.
And when Ethan died, the father comes through for him.
Well, all of these characters are looking for a mm-hmm. father or for, I don't want to, you know, it doesn't have to be a male figure necessarily, uh-huh. but Kate looking for a new husband. Here we have Mary Carr looking mm-hmm. for, identifying mm-hmm. her own husband and mm-hmm. in the wake of the loss of her mm-hmm. father mm-hmm. and Jeff and his father.
Well, part of the spirit of everyone is a night traveler, you see. You are, we're all engaged in some search that may be rewarded.
Uh-huh. Does it always happen at night? I mean, is it by necessity a night journey to discover yourself? Does it involve that these darker and more painful experiences that we have to go through?
Well, I don't know how deeply I wanted the title to be a metaphor, but it became to me a sort of metaphor of the hidden self that searches.
Elizabeth Spencer, I want to thank you for your time here on Soundings. Your book is The Night Travelers, published in 1991 by Viking. Thanks very much for coming by to participate. It's good to see you again.
Oh, it's good to see you. Thank you.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've just heard conversations with the writers Larry Brown and Elizabeth Spencer. Larry Brown's new book is Joe, published by Algonquin Books. Elizabeth Spencer's latest novel is The Night Travelers, available from Viking. If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 603. That's program number 603, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments and suggestions. Next week, Whigs, Warfare, and Civil Societies. My guests will be the distinguished historian Lawrence Stone of Princeton University and the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Edwin Yoder of the Washington Post Writers Group. Lawrence Stone will discuss warfare and the writing of modern history. Edwin Yoder will talk about his new collection of essays, a book entitled The Unmaking of a Whig. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.
Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Southern Voices, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for writers Larry Brown and Elizabeth Spencer. Larry Brown talks about Joe, his new novel, a parable of loyalty, betrayal, and violence set in the contemporary South. Elizabeth Spencer discusses The Night Travelers, her new novel about political morality and private lives during America's Vietnam years. Southern Voices, this week on Soundings.